Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Jules Gaylis, the Untitled Banner Podcast, the UBP, the UBP,
the
UBP. Sonic Frontiers will never be mentioned again on this podcast. It is done. 22 hours in, it is done. That game is a buggy mess. It is done.
I'm just going to say, I feel so vindicated. There was a meme that was doing the circuits after the UBP where I was just there like, yes, eating it all in. This Sonic Frontiers has come out, the fans have defended it in droves, and then all of the critics have weighed in and said, but is it really? And they were like, yes, it is. It's the best thing of the world. It's the best thing of the world.
I think,
and then there's the whole donkey thing that was coming out, and then it's like Stephanie Sterling went out on the front lines and said how they were just like not enjoying it as much. It was a piece of garbage, and then it was a case of I had a great time. I had a great time watching all of the fallout from this.
I would say that I'd call myself a fan. I do think it's fascinating, the fallout from it. It's not worth adamantly defending. There are clearly issues with it. Donkey's video was very much on point as to the obvious stuff that's up with it, like popping, like the physics bugs, and like the complete lack of polish and how rushed the ending is.
Favorite bit was the defenders being just like, well, of course, if you go to an area that's not been like fully finished or thought out and point out the bugs, then of course you're gonna have a bad time. It's like, no, that's not how it works. You don't get to pick and choose which glitches and errors and bad game design you do and do not talk about.
It's just like it's Sonic the Hedgehog, it's Sega, and it looks like that. Like, how are you not getting this right? I think the thing is this made me Google why does this keep happening, and it's because Sonic isn't big in Japan. I always thought that Sonic was like a global icon. He's not. Obviously, like, he was created in Japan to sort of very much contest with Mario in the West and everything.
Yeah, but wasn't he created in the very first instance to be a mascot for the West? So it was always from the off them saying, like, we are making something that isn't for the home market. And I imagine if somebody came out and just said, like, hey, look, we're creating this mascot and it's for, for Japan. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's going to have all of these stylings and tendencies that don't gel potentially well with the culture that you're in. So, of course, that mascot coming out, be like, well, it doesn't represent us. How are we meant to be, like, happy about this?
Well, that's the thing. Sonic was made to replace Mario. Like, wherever he was slow, he'd be fast. He was all attitude and whatever else, because Mario was more, like, subtle or whatever you want to call it.
Subtle.
And I couldn't think of a word there. I was like, restrained for the amount of wahoo that he does.
Yeah.
But still, I didn't realize that Sonic wasn't a thing in Japan, really. And so, like, I think that means that Sega don't allocate that much of a budget to the Sonic team. And you can tell, like, that's one of the things where, like, this game is the best Sonic game there's been since Sonic Generations, one of the top four overall, but it's still messy.
We're discounting Sonic Mania, are we?
I guess that's like a repackage, but that would be in there. Like, if you're fact, I'm going main canon. If you class,
I guess,
like,
we have to do
Mania.
3D games as well.
Yeah. I'm just thinking basically Sonic 2 is the best, Sonic 1's after that, then Generations, Frontiers. That would be mine. I wouldn't even be having Adventure in there. But still, Frontiers is, like, ambitious and cool, and the soundtrack's phenomenal. There are good things in it, but oh my God, it's not worth dying over.
So I'm just going to say here, at the very beginning of this podcast, you said we're not going to be talking about Sonic Frontiers. Here we are, a couple of minutes in, and we're still talking about it. So let's just put this in a box, right? And then we're going to send that box to hell. Okay, so here we go.
If something else comes up about it, because they said it was a... The director of the game referred to it as a global playtest, and we all kind of went,
is this now?
Like, so is this... Are you going to fix the pop-in? Is that a DLC? Like, what are we doing? And so if he addresses that again, maybe I'll pop back up. But yes, Sonic Frontiers is in the box. We'll bury it. And for my own sanity and yours, we'll try not to talk about it again.
I've heard about game devs coming and doing sort of patches after the fact, but to go out and be like, yeah, this was actually just a shadow sort of drop of a release. Like, that's a new one. Like, just be like, guys, this was just a demo. We forgot to tell you. It's early access, but not. You paid for it up front. Hey.
Yeah, like that wing of the fandom who's like, well, I can't wait to see what they do next. And it's like, no, you've already paid. They should have had it.
I'll tell you what, it's good. When you've got a fan base that is that dedicated, imagine just you're whistling trickling down to the cow shed as you milk them dry, because it's a case of you could yank their actual teat off, and like with the force that you're milking them, and they would still turn around and be like, oh, you can keep that, mate. Consider that a tip.
I'll grow one back. You can do it again. Don't worry about it. Yeah, do it again in the next few years. But yes, this is the Entitled Banter Podcast, where we take on your latest questions, talking points, and whatever else you'd like us to talk about in the industry. I don't know if I did. Our names. I'm Scott Tilford. You're Jules Gill.
I am indeed, unfortunately.
Fortunately for me, though. In terms of the questions, we'll try and get through as many as we can. Now, I was meant to mention this last week from Jack Jingle, who says, how much importance did you place on your significant other being a gamer, from the newly married Howie Jingles reporting for the Maldives on their honeymoon?
Well, to you, mate.
Congratulations and have fun. Although it might be over by now because I've missed it by a week, but it doesn't matter. What do you think about your significant other being into games?
The thing is that, like, it would be great to share interests with people, especially your loved ones, across the board. Like, every single thing you're in sync with. But I don't ever think that it's essential. I do enjoy the fact that video gaming is very much my thing and Kerry's got her own different stuff. But it's a case of we share a lot of other hobbies instead. So video gaming just potentially isn't one of them. And it's not that she hates video games. She is just, in her own words, just she doesn't think that she's very good at them. Right. But it's like, when we do sit down and play, she does enjoy them. Like, she really enjoyed playing through Guitaru Man, and we were playing through... She played a lot of Rock Band at university and stuff like that. And we played through Stray and stuff like that. So there's games that we do bond over, but they are just the Venn diagram of, like, her interests and mine don't usually overlap. I mean, the games I play are usually either Warhammer focused or intense tactical games where you have to spend like an hour planning your next move before you're even like ready to press click and get it done. Now, to a casual gamer, that's like the worst. That's the antithesis of gaming. You're spending this amount of time stressing out.
Like, yeah, I do quite like the emergence of, I don't have like a full term for it, but like backseat gamers, but in a positive way. That idea of, you know, you can both play through something like an Uncharted or something that's blockbuster, something that has those cinematic qualities. Like, when I got God of War Ragnarok in for review, and my wife was like, don't start it without me, and I was like, okay, I'll wait and we can do this together. And then it's like, I'm keeping her abreast of whatever's going on in the story, and then we'll do some of the major cutscenes. If something feels like something major is going to kick off, I'll pause and then, you know, give her a shout, and then like we'll do that together. But yeah, I guess it's like, how much importance do you place on your significant other being a gamer? I don't really. I think that it's like, it's awesome if you can match up, like you said. But it's, and it's great, the thing is, I'm debating buying Pokemon another Pokemon this year. I've already got Arceus, but the one that's out, I know the one that's out.
You mean the brand new GameCube game that's coming out?
The one that looks like it's sort of like looks like Morph, the one from like back in like 2002.
You can see the fingerprints and all that.
Oh my god, the latest trailer they did, I was like, oh, this is actually what you're releasing for £60. Like, this is actually what you've done. Like,
don't worry, mate, it's just a global playtest.
If one person starts doing it, they'll all start doing it. But yeah, I was going to get this year's second Pokemon, so we could actually play through it in co-op together, because that would be nice, because my wife's got a Switch for the first time ever, and I was like, that'll be sweet, and that sounds like a fun idea. And I always love the idea of co-op stuff, but I do find that like, you know, that idea of, like, you were saying about Kerry not being that comfortable with certain control schemes and stuff. Anything with right stick, constant camera control, or constant aiming, whatever, that just makes my wife run for the hills. Like, it's just the idea of aiming, and like, we try to play It Takes Two, and we got very far through that. But there's a lot of bits in that where it's like, pressurize, take out a bunch of targets, and she's just screaming, going like, I can't do it at all, I'm just getting killed. So yeah, I don't know if it's like, I like the idea of when it syncs up, it's fun, but I would never have a reliance on it.
I mean, this is the thing. If I was ever, and I pray to God that I'm not, put back onto the singles market again, if I was to look for shared interest, then maybe gaming would be a part of it. But I know how much like time it takes up out of it. I don't know. I wouldn't place on it as an importance of like, I'm falling in love with somebody because they are a gamer. It's just a positive if they do also enjoy gaming as well.
Yeah, I think for me as well, it has to be the other person has to have an allowance for you to game, because it's a long hobby. Like, you know,
it is. Yeah,
things take a long time. Maybe you need the TV or whatever it is, and it's like, you don't want to be like a dick about it, but at the same time, someone has to be able to respect that this is what you love doing. This is how you want to spend your time. And my wife is like, she bakes and she crafts and like, she's doing all sorts of reading comics and like playing her own Switch.
Yeah, because she's because she's doing the stuff that you potentially wouldn't want to do with her in that sense. So it's a case of like, you you've and again, it's not like you don't enjoy baking, it's not like you don't enjoy doing crafts and stuff like that. It's a case of just you're choosing to spend your time doing the gaming instead.
I think of it like a like one of those crisscrossing double helix things where it's like, we'll go our own way for a bit and then we'll cross over, and she might be like, oh, come help me with this recipe, or come to do this thing, or let's make this together, and I'll be like, hey, this cool thing just happened in God of War. So yeah, I think it works itself out. I think you just the importance is whatever you make it. Like, if well, it's like a clash, then
so like Kerry and I we enjoy doing like bouldering and climbing together. That's like the thing that we enjoy doing the most, and so therefore when that happens, that's when I'm the happiest, because I get to share a hobby with her. So I understand why some people would want to like get gaming as being their thing, but it just is nice to then go, I have climbing and I have my own thing. And I don't know about you, and not to get this into a relationship podcast, but sometimes if you spend too much time with the other person doing the exact same things all the time, then I imagine that your pool of things to talk about, because our interests are what define your conversations with that person. Your interests define who you are, and it allows you to mentally digest a lot of stuff that's been going on in the day. Like, sometimes I use gaming not as a space to play a game, but sometimes to unwind and do something that I like the Dynasty Warriors thing. It's repetitive gameplay, and my brain switches off and I can process other things.
You've got to play Vampire Survivors, by the way.
I really want to play it. I've actually seen it now, and it looks amazing.
It's on Game Pass. It's like the only control you have is the analog stick. You just move around and everything auto attacks, but it has such a Musou mentality that I was like, Jules would love this.
I'm very keen to play that game. And like, again, just going back to the point to finish it off, is a case of if you have too much shared interest, then I imagine that sometimes you're pool of conversationary topics is a bit drier. I'm not saying that that's true for everyone, but I'm just saying that that's something that I personally worry about.
Yeah, there's a reason that you wouldn't want to date your clone, like, because you don't want everything to be exactly the same. I think that it's like, yeah, like, you can complement each other, and it only leads to a better relationship or a better shared pool of things overall. Yeah, I think it's just whenever you can make it work, it's awesome. But for me, it's rare. But if I need to get through something for review, like, my wife is always like, just take the TV, just do whatever you want. You just do 10 hours, like, all day, fine. I think it has to be that, like, sort of shared understanding thing. I think if I was dating someone or marrying someone who the whole time I was playing was waiting for me to be done, that would just suck. Like,
yeah, that sort of pressure on you to finish, to spend time with them, I imagine that's not pleasant. So
Next question from DMD. Actually, sorry, I was going to talk to you about Game of the Year, because you mentioned that you played Stray, and I did a little bit of a rant on this week's podcast, because I don't think Stray is one of the six best games of the year, but I want to get your quick thoughts on that, because it's nominated as one of the six at the Game Awards.
Now, that is a genuinely surprising to me, because I don't think that Stray is definitely Game of the Year. Definitely don't think so, because while it has amazing aesthetics and it has like this great design philosophy, the puzzles, the actual delivery of that game, leave a lot to be desired. Like, the animations are very stiff and janky in some areas. I do find that the puzzles are very basic. They don't really feel like they're challenging you, and it's just a nice game. And I feel like it's like
it's equivalent. Not Sifu, was my thoughts.
No, exactly. And it's the equivalent of your popcorn blockbuster movie. You go in there, you get a rush of like sugar, and you walk away and you feel cool, that was a thing that I enjoyed in the moment, but I didn't go away thinking, oh, that was a deep reflection on the philosophy of the human existence. It was just a like is a game that has a cat. And I feel like maybe we are falling down the internet hole with this game, in the sense of has a cat does not mean is a good game. Like, the meme that took off when it was like, can you pet the dog in X, and it was like, even that new game that's just come out, which is all about like it's drawn like it's the Bayeux Tapestry,
Pentiment,
like, it was like straight away the first thing that came out of it was like, yes, you can pet the dog. So I don't care about that. It's a lovely little touch and a facet to it, but you are removing the tone and point of that game, which is to be heavy digestion of what it was like to be alive in that time.
Yes, I could not agree more. That was the thing. I just wanted to get your quick thoughts. I don't want to repeat everything I said on the main podcast, but that was my exact thoughts on it. I was just like, oh, it's the game with the cat in, therefore it gets voted for stuff. And it's obviously not the case. Enough people have voted, but still.
But like you said, Sifu is a phenomenal game. That literally changed my perception on way action games should be played. Mechanically, it was fantastic. And to have the revelation after the fact that when you go through the game, you then figure out you can forgive people instead, to break that cycle of violence, beautiful message to add on top of a game that arguably could have walked away from it and didn't need to put that extra bit in. But the fact that it does is what that game is about. It takes that step further and then kicks you in the face with it.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. Like, I mean, yeah, like we catch my rant on the main podcast, but I can only echo that. Like, it's like, yeah, Sifu, Tunic, there are just a bunch of different. Cold of the Lamb should have been the top six, stuff like that.
So what six have we actually got? So
the rundown of the top six, if I get it right, is God of War Ragnarok, Elden Ring, Plague Tale Requiem, Stray, Xenoblade Chronicles 3, and one more that I'm blanking on. But
that seems already that there's like one of these things is not like the other, because I can understand the... what's the first thing you think of when you look at the four or five of those games? Girth. Big, girthy games full of meaty emotions, fantastic animations,
Horizon
and a ton
is
of
the
love. And Horizon is a perfect addition to that because, again, it ticks all of those boxes. Mm-hmm. Actually genuinely surprised to see Horizon in the top one there. It feels like maybe they've just slid that one in there because of the fact is another big game that was released.
That's the thing,
because
right?
I've heard a lot of people say that while it is a very pleasant experience, it's not boundary pushing. I mean, Elden Ring, in my opinion, it deserves to win Game of the Year. And I know that it's been on everyone's lips and people are going into that weird thing that they do, which is we become oversaturated with the idea, so we're almost backlashing on it, saying it's not as good as you thought it was, yet those same people were a couple of months ago playing it feverishly and not able to sleep at night thinking about how to beat the Godskin Apostle and stuff like that. Like, this is a game that deserves recognition because it moved the... They don't like it being called an open world thing, by the way. I found that
out.
It moved the genre of what a From Software game is forward. It was the distillation of everything great about the Dark Souls, Bloodborne, Sekiro franchises into one game, and it does have its flaws, but it is faultless. It's a hypocritical statement, but that is what I feel of that game.
I could not agree with you more, Jules Gill. I absolutely love everything you just said. Yeah, I think that Elden Ring, I think we'll take it. God of War's a stellar video game overall. I've put more time into doing all the side stuff across yesterday, but Elden Ring's just gigantic.
I'm an absolute mug. I'm an absolute mug. Do you know what I did?
What?
I don't have a PS5. I don't have that. But I completely backseat gamed this. I've watched the entire thing. I've played the entire game watching other people play. I've experienced the entire game. And you know what? I've had a great time. But the one thing that I have noticed is that after watching people play through this game, I've just gone like, yeah, pretty phenomenal, like amazing writing, some great twists, but doesn't feel as strong potentially as I felt with the first one. And I watched other people play through that, so don't comment at me saying it's because you didn't get the hands-on experience. I watched other people play that as well before I got my hands on it.
I think it's an interesting one. There's a lot of stuff to talk about that are specifically spoiler-based for Ragnarok, but
we won't go into here.
But the things that game does, I think, advance video game storytelling. I think advance the medium. I think the way that it portrays parenthood and the challenges of parenthood and trusting your child and then literally like living through that as Kratos, like playing that character, I think that's pretty incredible.
I will gladly agree with you on all of that, apart from I would say that the narrative drive of it feels a little less focused than the other one. And I feel like that's my only comment on that.
Oh man, that was when I did the review, that's why I called it one of the riskiest sequels in years, because I don't think it does anything for about 15 hours. Like, it takes its sweet time. You probably would have skipped a bit of that if you were skipping past the gameplay, but in terms of like the amount of side stuff, there's only the amount of like content there is to do in that game before you're really dealt a decent propulsive narrative hand. I think it takes about 15 hours. Next question from DMD Does Gaming, who says, what's your favorite gaming snack, i.e. to snack on while gaming? Mine are salt and vinegar chipsticks. Now, I don't think you can beat that, but
you can because you can take them into overdrive. Do you remember we came over, this was back when Ben Potter and Peter Austin were still working with us, and we went over to your house to play the Dark Souls miniatures game, on the way we stopped at the little co-op that's by your house. So we went in there and I spotted these things which were listed as, my mouth is watering thinking about them because I've got a Pavlovian response to this. They were like salt and vinegar chipsticks in the same design, but they were listed as McCoy's Fish and Chip Shop salt and vinegar. And
I think I know what you mean.
Ye gods, mate. You put one of them in your mouth, it goes right through your tongue like it was the floor of the Nostromo and it was alien blood my God, like it melted, but it was so good because you're just like, I'm in heaven and in pain.
I always like when you have like way too many, well, I don't know if I like this feeling, but you know when you have way too many like salt and vinegar Pringles and your mouth just kind of shrivels up, it just kind of becomes like a towel holder.
Yeah. All the time.
It's just that thing.
Like, I have repulsive dry mouth to begin with. So that on top of it, I'm just like, oh, welcome to the desert. Welcome.
Like
to
me,
the
myself,
desert.
And Irene. Just yeah. But yeah, I would go with yeah. We, I guess we're both going to back chipsticks. I don't know why chipsticks don't have more of a cultural recognition, but I feel like they are. Everyone knows what Salt and Vinegar chipsticks are, but no main brand makes them. It's not like there's Walker's chipsticks or anything.
I would say that it comes down to whether or not you are a dip man as well, because I feel like if you are looking at the chips and the dip, I would gladly go for a subpar chip but have hummus as my dip, because that combo is good there. Or you go for the classic, I was going to say my mum's name on the thing, but I'm not going to. My classic Jules's mum's name. staple of ants on a log. If you've not had ants on a log as
a
kid,
living
mate,
hell is ants on a log.
Brother, let me tell you. Because what you do is you get you a stick of celery, right? You chop off those nasty ends. Get out of there. You're done. Then you fill the center canal with peanut butter, right? I know, right? the Mariana Trench full of peanut butter. Okay. And then you take some raisins or sultanas, your choice, dealer's choice, and you put them in a line down the middle of the peanut butter, and you have crunchy, salty,
yeah,
peanut buttery, and sweet, all in one delicious snack. It is a snack for 5-year-olds, but honestly, I feel like you enter this weird stage when you hit your mid-30s, which is you just regress suddenly. You just go you know what? I had life was better when I was 5 years old. Let's do some of that.
Kind of, or you have the boldness to try such things that would be laughed out the room if you were younger. I think because you approach it from an aged perspective, people will go along with it. Like, I feel like everyone's mum or dad or parent has a general thing of, oh, this is what you want. And my mum used to have apple slices with sugar and just sort of dip them
baller.
In sugar.
Baller.
Yeah, just that's
absolute
the thing.
Baller.
And there were some other things. Was like my wife has apple slices with peanut butter on top, and I'm just like,
see, again, peanut butter and apple. Peanut butter is life's lubricant, mate. It goes with everything. It just goes with everything. And
the best life, part makes is, life move better.
I think that maybe it's like a philosophy in your mind when like you reach a certain age and you know you just say like old people do not give a what about what they think. And I feel like it starts with food in your mid sort of 30s.
Interesting.
And because it's like now, if somebody comes up to me and be like, oh, ants on a log, you're eating a child's like snack while you're playing gaming. I'd look at them and be like, bro, like I'm not a violent man, but I'll stab you if you say that again. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'll stab you with the ants on a log, and then your body will bleed out in its delicious gooey goodness.
Don't make me make this recipe even tannier.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Do not make me slaughter in the name of ants on a log.
Someday I will try ants on a log, but maybe a problem with the marketing. I feel like it could be named better.
What do you want me to call it? What, Jules's sticky sweet stick? Well, we're not calling it that, are we?
No one's coming running to ants on a log, is what I'm saying. Even Jules's log would get them moving.
I tell you. Oh, mate, the What Culture merchandise store has just had another absolute popper. You can buy yourself the UBP mug, a nice little plug there, and you can also buy yourself the ants on a log recipe book. It's just one recipe, that's it.
Someday we'll do ants on a pod. That will be our food podcast. I should mention that Adam Took asked us what is in line for our game of the year. Is it just between God of War Ragnarok and Elden Ring? And then they mentioned the word that we shall not say anymore, whether that game was game of the year. But it's in a box now, so don't worry about it. Do you have a front runner for your particular game of the year?
It's got to be Elden Ring. I've had the most fun with it. I mean, I'm looking at my Steam playthrough time the other day, and I was just like, wow, 5 playthroughs deep, and I'm still just finding new areas to do it, because I went through the mindset of like, I will find and see and do everything on my first playthrough, realized that was near on impossible, so finished the game. Second playthrough, came for the comedy builds, stayed for the magic. Then it was like the third and fourth playthrough, rattled by, and I was just like, yeah, this is great. And now I'm finally going to new areas and just being like, wait, did I do this bit before? I've played the game so much, I can't remember if I've done it or not, so it feels brand new again.
See, everyone said that when you go through it the second time, that feels incredible because you're so over leveled. It's like new game plus. You can just like ostensibly one shot bosses and stuff. I've only ever done my one playthrough. It's over 100 hours, but I've just done the one. So would you recommend doing multiple playthroughs? I know there's other endings and stuff, but
I definitely would recommend doing it, but only if you go into the mindset with a completely different character build, because I did find when I went through for the second time, still kept on my high full strength build, and I was like, yeah, I've seen this attack animation quite a lot in the last billion hours that I played it, so maybe let's switch it up and do something else. Mm-hmm. Hell, I even for a second went absolutely mad and tried to make crossbows work. That ain't happening. That ain't happening, mate.
I think for my game of the year, it's definitely between Elden Ring and God of War. And I don't think I've come down on one side yet. I'm favouring Elden Ring just because of how much game is there. It feels like the next Skyrim. And it just feels like it absolutely nails everything it sets out to do. Whereas I would class some of God of War's pacing issues as an issue. Whereas like Elden Ring is just such an immaculate thing. Next question from Gula Lopa. Now, I think that's the name back when I took this question from it would have been Halloween period. And I must have written their name down. I forget what their actual real name is. But question from Gula Lopa. Will Waluigi ever get his own game within or independent of the Mario series? Can Nintendo properly capitalize on the meme-ness of good old Wally, or is it just a cough-cough pipe dream?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Dream.
Unfortunately, cough, cough, I think it is the pipe dream. I just don't see them doing it, man. I mean,
how do you not do like a bank robbery game with him, though? Because he's got the little, he could move with a big sack of cash and it'd be great.
I'm hoping, really hoping, that maybe we would be lucky enough in the fact that the Mario film might make like silly Mario become a thing, and Nintendo would lean heavily into it. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they've been so reticent to do anything with the Waluigi character does seem to prove that they don't really care what the regular public think about them.
He's a weird pick, isn't he? Like he was in Mario Strikers this year, and he got some of the best animations for goals and celebrations and stuff. And it's like, you guys, I know it's not Nintendo first party making that stuff, but they still have to make those calls and let the team do it. And I like it. There's clearly, they know what Waluigi means to the populace. Like, they get the Waluigi love, but I don't know if that goes away by capitalizing on it. I don't know if they're better off keeping him as like this, everyone loves him, but he's like the best like side character ever kind of thing.
I feel like what they should do is start thinking of ways to pair him up in games that are basically impossible to fail. Mm-hmm. So it's like if they did a new Super Paper Mario, have Luigi as the star, or do like another Bowser's Inside Story style thing, but with Luigi being one of the people.
Wait, Luigi or Waluigi?
Oh, Waluigi. Sorry, that's what I meant to say. But then it's like, it's because I was thinking of Luigi's Mansion.
Yeah, I was thinking
an obvious thing to do would be to just take a Luigi's Mansion, just do an expansion called Waluigi's Mansion, where it's just like him in the star role doing that, but using exact counter moves to Luigi. Or
I would take it as like
a two-player thing. Like, I don't know. I
view him as like a thief, like a robber. Just the way he has the big long legs and he sort of does that like old school, almost like a Looney Tunes style, you know, like a bank robber.
Yeah,
and I was
like,
you could put him in a mansion full of rich people, and he has to steal cash or something. I don't know, something like that, and you have to get away with it in different ways or something. That might be cool.
They should go for the gritty reboots. So it's Wario and Waluigi in like Forgotten Sons or something like that. And when like Epic realistic. Mickey came around and it was all like dark evil Disney, have like dark evil Nintendo. So it's like them and other forgotten villains from the past teamed together to finally kill Mario.
The day that Nintendo goes back to a gritty real world thing is like when they did their original Mario Brothers movie. And it's like that's the day they commit to like Naughty Dog style absolute, like Mario's just sick of collecting coins. He's got too many. What does he even do with them? What even is his purpose? Has a lifestyle decision. I did see that there's been a 1.5-minute trailer. It was trademarked or something for the Mario Brothers movie. So it seems like we're getting something else at the Game Awards, which is one of the assumptions anyway. So I guess we'll hopefully see more Chris Pratt voice. I guess I want to know more.
Well, we have to, because at the moment people are like speculating. It's like, oh, there's a little element of Italian or Brooklyn accent in him. So are there going to be more? So we just need to hear him more to finally make the final judgment call on whether or not he's going to be a good fit for the role.
I just want to see more of it, and I hope there's more Bowser in there too. Next question from Shane, who says, with Modern Warfare 2 being the latest game to cause a skill-based matchmaking debate, what are your thoughts on skill-based matchmaking as a system to encourage replayability or monetization for the newer guns, and does skill-based matchmaking get the thumbs up or thumbs down from ourselves? All the love, you legends, you. Well, thank you very much. When you come down on the old skill-based matchmaking thing,
So your level determines who you can play against?
Well, the whole debate is that like your performance in a certain match, if you've done really, really well in Call of Duty or whatever, and your KD, your kill death ratio is extremely good, then they'll put you in a much stronger match next time. So you're going to go up against a bunch of people who are closer to your skill level. So you'll have in theory, a better time, but like you won't be able to dominate as much. That's what it is in theory. I think the whole debate around Modern Warfare 2 was how skewed a lot of those metrics were, where if someone was doing very, very well, they would then get put in such a tough tier that it was just not fun at all. And I was like, I talked to Josh about this because there's a whole wing of Modern Warfare, or Call of Duty players, who are the no-scopers, who are like jumping around everywhere, who are slide cancelling, who are doing all the PC-based stuff, and it's just not fun to play against them. However, I don't mind skill-based matchmaking as a principle. It's just that you need to tweak the metric side of it correctly or address all the broken stuff.
I mean, I don't understand why this is even a topic of discussion. Every single multiplayer game worth its salt has two match modes, which is social and ranked. And ranked is the one where you get put into these higher league things because they actually matter to you more. So you go up against very competitive players. And in social, it's just a free-for-all. Like,
well, I think the idea sometimes, is that
sometimes
even...
Sometimes, and I know this is going to sound weird, some of the best experiences that I've had in a Modern Warfare game, in a Call of Duty game, have been going up against ridiculously hard teams that only have like maybe one or two good members who are dominating them, but because every single time you defeat them it feels great, and your team's gonna lose, but who cares? Matches are only 10 to 15 minutes, jump back into a new one.
I back that. Like when you manage to take someone out and it says like, you know, you've killed the leader or whatever, like Kingslayer or something, like I like that stuff.
It's the only time ever that I fully endorse teabagging to just be like, yeah, you know what, finally we have got our revenge on this person.
Yeah, and especially if you know that you're way down the ranks and it's like you just took out the guy at the top, you know that they are very annoyed on the other end of the microphone.
Like when we were playing Halo Infinite and we were going through the swap mode stuff, like we went up against a few teams that were just ridiculously difficult, but when we got that one or two victories over them for doing it for really knuckling down, we played better because we went up against stiffer challenges, and it was like, yeah, this is wicked, I feel like a better player because we're using teamwork.
True.
Admittedly, if you go through 50 matches where you lose every single one, you're gonna be a bit deterred if you just like have the same sort of stomping again and again.
Yeah,
but for growth, this thing,
like overall came from, it was a streamer called Tim the Tap Man who was just saying that he wouldn't be streaming Modern Warfare 2 because it still has skill-based matchmaking, which resulted in a bunch of different streamers and just general conversation around how sweaty quote-unquote Call of Duty has become with all the top tier players exploiting all the different physics things to beat everyone. And it was just that whole debate around like, how do you try and maintain competitiveness, or should it be more of like a free-for-all?
I guess in their case, because of the fact that it forces you to play in one way effectively, you either rise to the top and play in a homogenous fashion, where everyone does all the dash cancels and the jumping and the bunny hops and stuff like that, or you try and have fun and just accept that you're going to get punished every once in a while and then pushed back down the ranks to climb back up again.
Well, that was what I
can see that yo-yo might be frustrating.
Yeah, that's what I said to Josh. I was like, well, surely if you're doing really, really well, you then know that the next match you're in, like you've earned that. Like you sort of like, oh, that was your choice to play that well. But I think he was just saying that the way that the matches you get put into, it puts you in such a tough bracket with such a hard immediate skill ceiling or whatever, that you just have, it's just so not fun to go up against those kinds of players. But those are the only kinds of players that Call of Duty can suggest to you, because that's how their algorithm works or whatever. So it, for me, I like the idea of skill-based matchmaking on paper, as long as it's done well.
Do you think that it's one of those things that's going to level out over time, because of the fact that it's just at the beginning of the launch phase, obviously you're going to get people who are very good and have played Call of Duty for ages, and a ton of casual players that are going to come in. So you've got basically that huge pool of people on the ground floor, and you've got a very small select elite group at the top that are basically staying up there because they play at 24/7, nothing else. So when you bounce up, there are no middle floors. It's like taking the express elevator straight to the top floor. So over time, surely this should get better.
So, you'd think so. I mean, it's cool. It's weird. Like, how long are we in now? 15 years since Modern Warfare 1?
Yeah,
and it's just like, and we're
we
still getting some of the same issues at launch. Not necessarily skill-based matchmaking, but there's still issues with spawns. I had a guy just spawn right in front of me. I just got to kill him.
Yeah, those sort of things are just ridiculous.
Stuff like that, where it's like every year we have the same stuff. And skill-based matchmaking was just one of the issues that got thrown in the pile back when Modern Warfare first came out. But yeah, I like the idea of it on paper. I agree with you, though. It's like sometimes it can be like going from the bottom floor to the top and then going like, oh my God, I'm just absolutely getting slaughtered. I need to go back down again and then trying to find a decent middle ground. Next question from Andrew J, who says, in Australia, Pokemon Sapphire and Violet is listed at almost half price before its release. Is this kind of discount a red flag from a company notoriously stingy when it comes to discounting their games? Also, Jack Asbury says, what starter are we picking in the new Pokemon? I don't even know if you're getting the new Pokemon.
I ain't getting the new Pokemon, I'll tell you that much, mate. I'm about seven Pokemon removed from my last game, and I left it on a high note with Heart Gold. One of the best Pokemon games out there. And I'm not just saying that for nostalgia, because I actually came back to that way after it was released. A friend of mine gifted it to me, and I was like, this game is sick.
Oh, I've bought ever since I got back into it on Pokemon Go. That was the one that made me just live on Pokemon again. I've bought every annual installment since then, including this year's Pokemon Arceus, which I feel like it's almost a meme now. I say I have over 100 hours in something, but I do in Pokemon Arceus. I absolutely loved it. I can't, like, looking at Sapphire and Violet, Scarlet and Violet.
Yeah.
I don't want to give them that much money for something that looks that bad. And I get that all the gameplay improvements are cool, but I also don't trust the Switch to run them very well. Like, even in the trailers, the frame rate is terrible.
Yeah, it looks
and I'm just like, looks like janky, and it's like no background detail is there. But in terms of the, which I guess that could be a contributing factor to the price being lowered, because they kind of get that the reception to this one is a lot more negative than it was going into Arceus. I mean, the thing that's not really been talked about is how Nintendo are doing what Ubisoft did in 2014. They're releasing two of the same game in the same year. Like when Ubisoft did it with Assassin's Creed Unity.
Yeah, just it's overkill. Absolutely overkill.
Yeah. And it's like Nintendo are just like, well, they're Nintendo, so whatever, we just don't criticize them. But they are fleecing the market.
So I'm looking at the three Pokemon starters now. So you've got Sprigatito, Fuecoco, and Quaxly.
Yeah.
Okay, so just looking at these here. Do you know what? I don't hate any of them.
No.
I actually think that the designs are really cool, because you've got the nice pompadour on Quaxly.
I do like I like that, yeah.
I like that Fuecoco is kind of like an apple and a crocodile at the same time, and the other one's just a cat. So if we're going to go on game of the year mode, then Sprigatito.
Well, yeah, it's an immediate top six of the year. So
yeah, exactly. But I personally would choose Quaxly just because of the fact that he's reminding me of Dodgeball Academia's Arno, I believe his name is, who also has a nice like slick back pompadour and kind of giving off Travis Touchdown vibes as well.
Yeah, I was going back to Quaxly. I've not seen what their evolutions are, but I remember there was a in Sword and Shield there was a I can't think of the creature, but their middle evolution was like an emo thing where they got like a big fringe.
Amazing.
And I was like, that's such a cool thing to go for. But yeah, I would probably go with Quaxly as well, just because I'm curious what that thing turns into.
Yeah,
what do you think about the price stuff? Do you think looking at Sapphire and Violet, it looks remotely worth the money?
No, definitely not. For me, I looked at that and I was just like, cool, that is a hard pass. It couldn't be any harder for me to walk away from that. It is a bit of a red flag to have them on sale before they're released. I don't think I can remember any game that comes out with that. I mean, the question...
It's like pre-order price.
The question would be, why do that? You've already got a huge market of people that probably would buy it at full price anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you've got a bit of bad press, but you've got to remember that most of the people that you're marketing to, aka the sort of like 10 to 13 year olds who readily snap up this stuff regardless, that's just another excuse for them to spend money. So
I've just looked, actually, it's
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, it's listed as $47.99 for Argos in the UK, and there's a $42.99 price as well for at very.com. So it seems like it's lots of £40, between £40 and £45, which is like obviously down from like even like Breath of the Wild is still going for £50 or £60.
Yeah, that's just odd. Very odd.
So I don't know how much they're just aware of, you know, we've already done Pokemon Arceus. Some people are still playing through that. And then it's just that idea of like, can we sell you another two games? Obviously, people pick one, but still. Yeah,
but it's Christmas time. Like, Now is the time not to offer sales or stuff like that. It's the time to basically go, yeah, cool, Christmas is here, and you're going to have basically pressure from every single company in the world to spend.
Oh, I think they'll do both. I think you'll get your little like price thing now. You've got your Black Friday in a couple of weeks, and then you've got the console bundles for Christmas.
I mean, going back to the original commenter's question, I guess that, yeah, it does just signal that they have zero faith in this game. They know that as soon as it comes out, it's going to get lambasted by critics. So, of course, they've just gone, right, let's make as much money as we can rather than just go for the small contingent of people that would buy at a higher price.
I think as well, I think I got its name wrong twice. It's Scarlet and Violet. That's what I think I was saying Sapphire. But there's so many at this point. There's two a year for the longest time we could remember. Next question. Final question from Vernon Punk Bass, who says, UBP, hope your legends are doing well. What is a game that you don't feel gets enough love? Mine is Legend of Legaia, a classic RPG with great story, innovative combat and a summon system, customizable gear, and packed it all into a PlayStation 1 disc. Please play this game if you can find a copy. Now, I played Legaia 2 on PS2, which I loved because I went through a whole turn-based RPG, anything that was turn-based, like Grandia or Legaia, I mopped that up. So I can back the sequel to that, but I've not actually played the original. I don't know if you played the Legaia series.
I think I have. I think it's got some sort of like Japanese anime protagonist on the front of it. That might be a Lundra, though. I'm not entirely sure. I get those two confused.
Legaia dude's got like blue hair, I think. I think if I'm remembering the box art.
Let me just
you look up Legaia 2. Let me tell you.
Legaia 2. Let's have a look here. So,
because I love that whole period where it was like, if you were into JRPGs, there were so many. There was like a different one every 6 months.
Oh, I know the one you're thinking of there. Damn, that is as generic as a box of cover art that you can have, man. But was it good, the sequel?
I love too. I mean, like I said, it was like that idea of just sort of like JRPG 101, but it did have, I mean, the thing is, I'm going back like almost 20 years at this point.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking the combat system was cool. I'm sure there was a brawler character that you kind of dialed in their moves a little bit like Tifa in Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, nice.
Where you were picking different paths through the combat that you wanted to do. And I remember liking the story. I remember thinking that was really cool. And I'm sure it was one of the Grandia games, Grandia 2 or 3, that I really like gravitated towards as well. It was just, I liked that whole era, considering when I was like a young teenager, of like you could name your characters after yourself. So it was like you were going on this grand journey, and then just every character was like, Scott's gonna save the world, and I was like, I'll do that, I'm 10. And so like I was all over that entire boom that came from Final Fantasy VII.
I absolutely love the fact that it's usually games where the characters would be called like Cecil Pithelwhip the Third, and then it would be like Jacoby Pringleface, and then it just goes like Scott. It's like, go Scott.
I mean, you gotta make it work. I think but I like even though it was super budget, when you look at it now, like it looks like it was made for about £10. At the time, it was in that specific boom where like people like Vernon Punk Bass is saying, if you pick those games up at the time, they really stood out. What would you have as your game that doesn't get enough love? Doesn't have to be an RPG.
Well, Scott and Vernon, my game that does not get enough love but still deserves it is the PS2 classic Gladius or Gladius? It's a sword, isn't it? A Gladius?
I believe so.
Yeah, that sounds right, Jules. Uh-huh. That's just say it with confidence and that'll be fine. It was a
I'm looking at this, like the Roman Colosseum game.
Yeah, it was a turn-based squad game where you would basically fight in arenas around the world to become the champion of champions. Plus it had some sort of like crazy overarching plot of like lots of conspiracies and evil things, but you could go and recruit different members of other gladiators to your team. Yeah. And you can have big hulking brutes, the style that would be in Gladiator the film, you know, that fight that he has with the ghoul, remember that? You can get a guy who looks pretty much bang on that. You can get like wolves to fight with you, archers as well, and it's a game that used verticality quite well. Where you'd have like little boxes or little ruins and you jump on top of it and it would give you advantages about people you were attacking below. Getting the high ground was actually like very important and not just a meme. So yeah, it was really fun game. Really,
that thing
really
looks sweet. There was a game on PS2 as well called like Spartan Total War or something. There was like a more like God of War style one.
Yeah.
I remember being really, really chunky and everyone recommending it. I never actually played it, but okay. I just remember that little Spartan boom that we had because of God of War. You sort of had a few other games that were similar in terms of Roman stuff. I tell you what I was going to shout out, because the other day I was editing an article and someone mentioned the Blade 2 game. And I don't know if
you played Blade 2. No, I didn't play that, but that is... I remember when it came out, though.
I used to love the Blade 2 movies, one of my favourite movies. It still is one of my favourite action movies, but that game had a right analogue stick fighting system where it was like, in all the articles going up to it, you can move the stick in different directions and like parry and do all these things. And then when you got it, it was just like, you move the stick and you just like one animation and one animation.
So
and one
basic,
you could chain
it?
Like some parts of it, but not very much. And I remember the PS2 version couldn't even handle the flow of his coat. It was only on the Xbox version. So I remember coming home with it being like, oh, Dad, it's the wrong one.
But that just reminds me of, there was a Tom Clancy game that came out. I know it was one of the Rainbow Six games, and it came with a headset, and it was like the first one to try and popularize using the headset to speak to your team to get them to do actions.
SOCOM,
so you would
awesome.
Like, so you'd be like breach and clear, and then they would do the animations to do that, even though all it took to do the exact same motion was to hold down one of the buttons and then press like a directional thing to do it. But the fact that it made you feel like you were in charge, I was like, this is amazing. But then I remember watching my dad play it, and he doesn't have an accent. Like, I don't have that much of an accent apart from a British one. But my dad has maybe more of like a Southwest accent, maybe. But watching him just be like, breach and clear like that, it just like, it didn't work for him, but it worked for me, so he was getting really frustrated with it.
I remember when, because it was like
traded it in like the next day because he got annoyed at it.
That game was such a cool, because like, that was like Conflict Desert Storm and SOCOM and like all those
Conflict
like squad
Desert
shooters.
Storm,
I know,
man.
They were so cool. And it's like SOCOM, I remember getting home because he had the headset and stuff, and it was like pure dad joke where it was like fire at will, and then my dad is just like, oh, who's Will, or watch out for Will. But at the time when it worked, it was cool. But yeah, that was like that was a whole point in time.
I've got just one, we'll leave it on one story, one Conflict Desert Storm story, which is when I was playing that game, me and my friend Liam were playing through the game co-op, like relentlessly, absolutely loved that, because we were trying to get like, I think it ranked your thing out of like how many stars you could get to the end, and I think 3 stars was like the best you could do. And the first level has one of the players set on one side of the map, and the other player is locked in a jail cell.
Yes.
And they need to wait until the other player comes and frees them. And there's like about 20 enemies along the way that you could just run through and run and gun, but I wanted to do a challenge where it was just only using the knife and stealth. And oh man, I feel so sorry for Liam. He must have watched me play that level, that opening level, because he would never play as player one, obviously. I was that character, he was the other character. He must have sat there waiting for me for like hours of his life, because every single time I got spotted, I was like, can I do it again? He's like, yeah, do it again. But he was as hyped about it as I was when it finally happened. I was like, I did it, I'm freaked you without getting good. And as soon as we walk around the corner, alarms go off. It's like, yeah, we did it though.
That whole thing though, again, like, yeah, I mean, we'll end this podcast, but that game had a really, really cool feature where if you played it single player, because it was a great co-op game, but if you played it single player and you switch to a character like a sniper and you put them on like a perch or something, and you put them in like the ready state, so they're ready to fire, and then you switch back to your other dude, the AI would take over, and then you could like run in whilst covering yourself. And I was like, no other squad game ever did that for single player squad stuff. No. It always feels like now a squad game is just like a loot shooter or something with like with no AI at all. Whereas like, yeah, Conflict Desert Storm arguably got it right in like 2002. It was just
crazy.
Like way back then.
We should do like a list on it where it's like video game mechanics that were perfect the first time around or something like that.
Yeah. Just an excuse to talk. I guarantee there'll be people out there reacting to Conflict Desert Storm. That was a thing back then. But yes, for now, this has been the Untitled Panda Podcast. The UBP. I've been Scott Tilford. You've been Jules Gill.
I have indeed. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for sending in all your questions and talking points. And we'll catch you next week.
Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.